Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.
It's a marvelous night for a moon dance with the stars up above in your eyes. A fantabulous night to make romance beneath the cover of October skies. Get all the leaves on the...
What's up? What's up, everybody? Welcome aboard to the Bubba Show. It's Todd Bubba Horowitz and I bring in my guy, my man from London, and from sunny London. It's too hot there for him, but he's my guy. Dr. Bob Swore from Camdor Global and author of the famous best-selling book, Money Mania, Panics, Booms, and Busts, and this is going to be busting soon. But what do you say, Dr. Bob? How are you?
I'm doing well, Todd. How are you doing?
You know, I'm doing okay, except that I can't take it anymore, Bob. I cannot take the Federal Reserve anymore. I would like to stick pins underneath my fingernails. Every time I hear them come out, I think that they're doing so much manipulation that to me it's becoming beyond anything that I could ever have imagined. What do you think?
Well, I think that you know, if you look at policymakers are caught in their own economic straitjacket now, right? And I think they're stuck. They don't know the way out. And so the only thing they can keep doing is digging deeper and deeper, hoping that somehow they'll break out on the other side of the globe eventually.
But we know that they're not going to. And I got a theory. Let me ask you. Let me run this by you, okay? Because you are one of the smartest guys I know, and you are an economist. So even though I yell at how bad I hate economists, I love because you're a good guy. But okay, so my theory is that for the last 3 or 4 weeks, the Fed has intentionally been bringing out Lockhart and Dudley and others to talk up a potential rate hike, trying to get a feel for what the market was going to do. And the market stayed in a consolidation range through pretty much of that time. And then on Friday, something spooked the market a little bit. And they're blaming it on rates, but I say it was something else. But in the meantime, they spooked it, and they kept Brainard as the cleanup hitter so that if she had to come out and talk dovish right before they go into their silent period. So now we know for sure they're not going to raise rates. Not that they ever were, but I think they did this intention to try to get a feel for how the markets would react. What do you think?
Look, I think they're all trying to feel the market carefully, because the problem they have is that, you know, one of the problems with this whole notion of forward guidance is you tell the market that you're going to tell them exactly what the future's like, which makes no sense. I mean, you can't predict the future. And so they get caught up in this whole shenanigan of, you know, should we move? Should we? I think the worst part is that, you know, in reality, I suspect most of them know that you have to figure out some route towards normality. If you don't, then there is, unfortunately, the way the situation gets better. I mean, if you look at the way this has gone right now, you have a situation now where, you know, this has now become something that's damaging the viability of the banking system, because banks really can't function in an active rate environment. You have a situation where in Europe, for the first time, you've actually got corporate bonds issuing at negative levels, whereas before they were simply trading at that. And, you know, if you look around out here, beyond the fact that you've got this whole situation with banks, I mean, the war on savers has reached terrifying proportions. I mean, today they announced that in the UK, for example, the combined deficit of the pension schemes in the UK on the private side had reached £460 billion. Yeah, think about that. I mean, you know, that is a roughly, what, $650 to $700 billion deficit. In the US, it's probably triple that.
Right. And so, Dr. Bob, I mean, you're a genius. You understand all this, and you know how to speak about it in a way that I like, that I can understand. Okay, versus when Yellen talks, I have no idea what she's saying. I don't think she knows either, but it sounds good. But so now here we are, and we continue to build debt. Which you last time you were on, we talked about how bad the debt was, and the debt's only growing. How far can they actually go with the method that they're trying to use? I mean, at some point, does it have to run out? I don't know. How deep can you print? How much can you devalue the currency that you have? I mean, is there a point in when it does actually run its course, or can they print forever?
Look, they can't print forever. I mean, I think the thing is that it's simply a case of how much longer can you keep the charade going? And people keep believing that somehow there's a way out. The simple reality is that when you look at the amount of debt out there, there is no way that a good chunk of that isn't bad debt. It is. There is unfortunately no two ways about it. I mean, you look, for example, at what most pension plans, endowments, insurance companies are doing. They're buying yield like it's going out of business, because it is. So in anything that has even a sniff of a yield, they'll buy it. You know, you look at the direct lending funds, for example, that have grown tremendously in size over the last few years. A lot of them have simply stepped in and replaced the debt providers to the leveraged buyout market. So, you know, there's plenty of cheap debt around. If you're in the right sector, if you're the right size, you have, unfortunately, no shortage of debt. And so, you know, if you look at corporate leverage in America, for example, one of the largest corporates, you know, it's at record highs. And the truth of the matter is, some of that debt is good debt that can be paid back. A lot of it probably is bad debt. So you've unfortunately reached that point. The question now is that do they turn around and hope for a tragic Japan-style scenario, at least you work that debt off very, very slowly over a number of decades, or do you actually try and, you know, get that system back to normality sooner? Unfortunately, I think the system, one way or the other, is going to break before it gets there. Either people lose faith in the viability of the debt, but even if, say, for the sake of arguing, the markets keep believing it, even if the participants in the market, like you and I, keep getting seduced by the notion that the Fed can somehow solve problems, where they're already losing the battle is unfortunately in the wider population. I mean, populism, you know, is on the rise, and that's a direct reaction to this growing gulf between, you know, the perceived elite and the everyday man.
So, you know, you have the debt structure, which is horrible. You have an economy that certainly has to melt down at some point. But my problem here, Dr. Bob, is that if we would let the markets decide and let the markets trade for themselves, we would probably be in a heck of a lot better shape, because they would figure out what the right numbers were, and the Fed wouldn't have to be involved in all this stuff, because certainly they've way overstepped their bounds. What do you think?
Well, I mean, the market has no pricing mechanism to speak of anymore, right? I mean, if you go back and look at savings pools in the market as an example, you know, one of the reasons why pension funds and insurance companies developed was, you know, the bond market didn't really exist 50, 60 years ago in the same way. It was much, much smaller. And while you had a few bonds, there weren't really significant buyers out there. You know, when you started taking all these little pockets of savings that individuals had and you started collecting them, you kind of create these gigantic pools that suddenly could go out and fund all of the debt demand in the economy. And I think that really, you know, provided a lot of growth to the economy, which people don't fully appreciate. Now, what you're doing is you're slowly destroying those pools, and therefore you're slowly actually hollowing out and destroying the bond market over time. That's one thing you're doing. The second thing you're doing anyway is, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of banks, but, you know, the way they've now done the yield curve, they are slowly forcing the banks to also break up that business model. You know, most banks now don't really want to hold cash from somebody else because it's a huge drag on their returns. They're all downsizing. You know, in this country, for example, in the UK, Royal Bank of Scotland announced that for business customers, they will slowly start now introducing charges for holding deposits because, frankly speaking, they can no longer afford to hold them. Money market funds, you know, are pretty much being put out of business for the same reasons. And the thing is, you know, that has huge implications, because actually what it weakens is it weakens the flows of money between economies, between people, between companies. And you can see the impact of already with global trade. Global trade over the last year has not simply stagnated or slowed down, it's actually started to decline. So you're in a position now where forget whether you believe that debt is already paid back or not, forget whether you believe the central bankers can keep printing ad infinitum. The fundamental pinnings of an economy, which is people trading with each other, is declining.
That's a great way to end it. Now, hold on 1 second. That's a great way to end the segment, because that's a big thing, the velocity of money. I'm with Dr. Bob Swarup, Candor Global, author of Money Mania, Booms, Panics, and Busts, the best. He's going to tell it like it is. This is The Bubba Show, Todd Bubba Horowitz. You missed an episode, LibertyTalk.fm. We'll get you the download. The Bubba Show, Todd Bubba Horowitz. We'll be right back with Dr. Bob Swarup, The Bubba Show. Right. Welcome back to the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz with Dr. Bob Swarup from London. Too sunny from today, but he's from London. And he's got the book, Money Mania, Panics, Booms, and Busts, bestseller. But so, Bob, you were talking about basically the velocity of money, that nobody wants to trade and money doesn't move, which is another problem all to its own, is it not?
Yeah, look, money doesn't really move around. I mean, what's happening is that, you know, money isn't flowing through the economy anymore. You only look at the velocity of money charts on Fed to see that, you know, it's been declining steadily. And, you know, the problem is money is basically pooling at the asset end, which is why you've got huge asset price inflation. But, you know, beyond that, if you look at, you know, trade, as I mentioned before, trade is declining. So, you know, the basic underpinnings of an economy, which is just transactions between one person and the next, those are declining because the flows of credit are weakening, the links of credit are weakening. So, you know, what you're actually doing, ironically, is much as you're creating all sorts of bad debt, you're fundamentally also breaking the credit linkages that hold an economy together at the same time. And it's a little bit of an oxymoron. And I think what you're really seeing right now, and I don't think it's the start, I think it already began for probably about 3-4 years ago, is you've now started a phase of deglobalization. So in other words, if you think of globalization being defined as the economic environment where trade grows faster than economic growth, in other words, people are making more and more money, and ultimately economic growth also benefits from that. Deglobalization you can define as a time when, you know, trade is either declining or growing slower than economic growth because people are becoming more inward focusing. We're now in that phase. This is not dissimilar to the period between, you know, 1913 and 1945, where, in effect, you look at any economy around the world, take the US, you take the UK, take India, China, any of them, pick one. They're all starting to look inwards. They're all worried about their domestic worries. You know, people are worried about their job security, about their retirements, about whether they actually have a say in what's going on. And so what you have is, you have a whole host of populations who are now voting and people who are basically focused on domestic poverty. They may not understand money, they may not understand the economy, but they don't really care. They have a mandate being given to them by a population to give them a better deal. So unfortunately, that usually ends pretty badly.
And it will. But now, obviously, you're an investment guy. You're around. You're one of the smartest guys I've ever met. And can take both sides of the argument. You understand it from the side of an economist. You understand it from the side of an investor. What is an average investor to do today? I mean, what are the things that you look at, Dr. Bob, as a investment advisor? What are some of the things or the areas that you'd be looking to put money in right now?
Look, I think if you buy into the thesis that you are in a deleveraging world, broadly speaking, and a deglobalizing world, that's a world where capital is actually getting more and more scarce in key parts of the economy. You know, as I said, if you're a large corporate, if you've got a rating given to you by one of the big guys, you have no problem raising money. But, you know, there's so many companies out there that are small companies, that are unrated companies, that cannot get capital for love or money. So lending into a deleveraging environment, you are a rare provider of capital, and the competition generally is going away. So I think that's a great area. I think if you look around, there are plenty of distressed assets that are slowly appearing in places. So a simple example is the commodity space. And the commodity space between, you know, the China story going all wrong, and of course, sheer amount of leverage a lot of guys took on, you have a huge, you know, valuable pool of assets out there, which at the moment, unfortunately, are in deep need for workout. And it's not as simple as, you know, saying, great, I'm going to buy it for nothing. The problem is most of these guys are stuck short of key bits of financing, and they no longer have a bank that can step in to provide that. They no longer have an investor community that buys into their thesis. At the same time, let's face it, you know, the world's not going to stop consuming energy tomorrow. So, you know, there's some interesting assets out there from that perspective. I mean, on a shorter-term basis, you can always try and trade the greater fool theory, which is that as long as you believe central banks have further rope to run, you can keep playing the duration game and basically, you know, trying to almost front-run those trades. But that's a more dangerous game because then ultimately, if you're wrong-footed, it's like a carry trade. You get carried out with the rest of the
hopes. You do get carried out. So if you look at things, so, you know, you mentioned, I mean, I'm a big believer right now in agricultural commodities. They're just, you know, obviously with the action that's been going on, they have been just absolutely getting slammed. And I mean, they're at prices not seen in 15 or 20 years now. Do you buy like individual commodities like that? Is that a trade that you guys would make or an investment, or are you looking for more of a, of the fund type of stuff?
Well, we'd be looking more to acquire the hard assets, you know. Okay. So you know, I think if you take, for example, you know, mining assets, agricultural assets, I mean, you know, rather than buying the commodity, because the commodity itself comes with a lot of volatility. There's going to be a lot of sentiment around it, and especially because of policymakers, I think every bit of news tends to impact the stuff. So if you're trading it, I think you can make some good money out of that volatility, although it's hard to predict these days. I think what I find more interesting is that you get pockets of commodities that are going to come up, which are critical commodities of one sort or the other for future economic growth, but they're not, unfortunately, going to be, you know, easily accessed. As a really simple example, take nickel. You know, India, which is, you know, growing again, India imports all of its nickel. It does not have any nickel in at all. So if you were to, for example, be provided nickel, nickel market is depressed right now, but a high-quality nickel deposit, if you can acquire it cheap enough, probably has an excellent upside potential. And there, you know, you're getting the benefit of both the upturn and the commodity price as when that happens, eventually, hopefully. But importantly, you actually also have a demand upsurge that will come in due course. So even if the price stays where it is, in terms of the wider markets, the demand going up should raise the value of what you got. So you get the equity uplift as well.
So, you know, so you're looking at like, so are you a gold fan here?
Look, I'll tell you, I mean, I'm not a believer per se in the gold standard, simply because I think gold, like almost any other currency, although a bit more honest than most, is still unfortunately subject to human behavior and human whims. But I will say this much. Gold, to my mind, is a put option on central banks. That has increasingly become the case. And if you look, for example, at some of the recent literature that's coming out and some of the recent commentary, there is this enormous start, I would say, of a war on cash that is going beyond simply devaluing you know, the interest rate down to nothing and the negative, to actually this huge talk now of whether cash itself should be removed from an economy, whether things should be entirely digital. In that scenario, you know, you really are forcing people to think more and more about hoarding and preserving what value they do have. Because if you're in a society where people trust the government or the policymaker less and less, you try and find a source of value that could be a real asset or gold or something, which the policymaker you believe cannot control in the same way. So gold, to my mind, has a lot further to go from that perspective. The other thing to bear in mind is that one of the biggest arguments against gold used to be the fact that you had to effectively pay a storage cost for gold. Well, guess what? In a zero to negative cash environment, gold actually gives you a positive real return just by holding it.
You're right. So, I mean, now, do any of the, what do they call them, cryptocurrencies, do those make any sense to you? You know, the Bitcoin type of thing, is that anything in your world?
Well, I mean, I think that the cryptocurrencies, I think, have some interesting speculative aspect around it. One of the real problems with cryptocurrencies is that they are not yet widely accepted. In general, you know, for something to become a true currency, it's something that you can trade pretty easily with almost anyone, which you can use as payment for all sorts of things without worrying about, you know, government sanctions or interference or controls or things like that. I mean, the problem with cryptocurrencies is that, you know, something like Bitcoin has the problem that the fact that they fixed the maximum amount of Bitcoin that could be mined, that I don't know, was 21 million, means that it's a currency that by definition has a finite supply, which means it's inadequate to meet people's needs. And unfortunately, like pretty much any currency out there, what you're relying on is the belief that this little bit of computer code that you've got sitting somewhere is actually somehow going to be immutable and as valuable 5 years from now. I think that's a pretty tough call to make. I mean, gold, at least, if there's one thing you know about gold, it's that they're mining less and less of it, yes, but that it actually has had a perceived store of value that goes far beyond simply a few people who play in the financial markets and are obsessed with, you know, technology.
This is Dr. Bob Swarup from Camdor Global. Oh, man, you are smart. You got me going, baby. This is Money Mania, Panics, Booms, and Busts. This is The Bubba Show. You missed an episode, libertytalk.fm. I'll get you the download every day. We're going to step by here for a break. We'll be back with more from Dr. Bob Swarup from Camdor Global after the break. The Bubba Show, Todd Bubba Horowitz. We'll be right back.
How about you?
Trust. For nearly four decades, that is the reputation Roberts & Roberts Brokerage has forged with their customers. Now, with their full e-commerce website, rrbi.co, it's easier than ever to buy or sell precious metals via Bitcoin or major credit card. Visit them online at rrbi.co or call 800-874-9760 to speak with an experienced professional today. Roberts & Roberts, when you're serious about precious metals.
What's up, everybody? Bubba here. It's finally here, the long-awaited Bubba Report, bringing you news from all the trading floors across the globe. We've got Scott Cialady, the cow guy, as seen on CNBC, Fox, and Bloomberg. We've got Keith Bliss, CNBC, Fox, and a floor trader at the New York Stock Exchange. We've got The Badger, who writes the hot topics in the political news. We've got myself putting together my own unique indexes that will help you give you a better idea of what's going on in the market. All you need to do to get a hold of the Bubba Report is go to thebubbashow.org and sign up for the newsletter, or you can email me direct at bubba@thebubbashow.org. We want you to have this report because we've got over 150 years of experience talking about markets, getting ready for the trading, and puts you in the best position to have successful. So email me at bubba@thebubbashow.org to get a copy of your report, or go right to the website, thebubbashow.org. Make sure you get it. It's a must-have for every investor and trader. The Bubba Report. Welcome back to the Bubba Show. Todd Bubba Horowitz with my man, Dr. Bob Swarup from Camdor Global, author of Money Mania, Panics, Booms, and Busts. And we got a panic coming on here now. But so Dr. Bob, you know, we look at all these different things. Now, here's one of the problems I have, you know, in regards to gold. You know, there's obviously many, many of these paper assets, these paper gold, these ETFs. And I think that gold is over-papered. I think that we don't have enough gold for all the paper that they've sold, in my opinion. Now, I know that a couple of weeks ago, Deutsche Bank did not honor some redemptions that people were looking for on their paper gold. And I'm wondering, is that a true concern, or am I overreacting?
Well, this goes to my point I was saying earlier about why I don't believe in the gold standard. Because the thing is that much as you have fractional reserving in the fiat money system, you actually also have fractional reserving in the gold system. I mean, typically the amount of gold that sits in a vault probably has been lent out or sold several times over. And usually all that happens is they kind of move the bar from one corner of the vault to the next. I mean, if you remember going back to the German experience, I mean, don't forget Germany asked for its gold back from the Americans, from Fort Knox. And I believe, you know, if I remember correctly, they got told it would all be paid out gradually over time.
Right.
You know, the implication being it's just not there to give it to the Germans straight away. So you know, I think... There isn't enough gold out there, and also you got to remember that so much of the trading in gold, you know, in the futures market and so on, and also, you know, a lot of the ETFs, frankly speaking, very few of them actually have physical gold sitting in a vault somewhere, which exactly matches what they've got. There just isn't enough of it out there.
All right, so, I mean, I think that's a problem, and again, I'm with you. See, I'm kind of confused in the overall system, okay? Now, obviously, we live mostly on the Keynesian system, which I think is flawed. But again, I'm not saying anybody else is better. I think there's probably a combination of things that could make everything better, and I don't know why. You know, it's kind of like politics. We're divided. Either got to be a Keynesian or a Western. I mean, yeah, I think there's probably a better mix of all when we look at it. But at the end of the day, you know, you want to be able to hold something. And what bothers me today, Dr. Bob, is that you mentioned this a little earlier, but the elimination of cash. Okay, we already see them trying to get rid of the big bills everywhere, and I think that someday there'll be no more money. And what do we do then, and what does it mean if that happens?
Yeah, I mean, see, I think the ability for cash to be devalued becomes far, far easier. The advantage, of course, of having something that slightly sits outside the control of a government is that it enforces some level of honesty or enforce at least some level of accountability. I think the danger here is that I don't think anyone is doing that in malice, but I think there is a genuine belief that somehow they could get all these wrinkles out of the system, such as people, you know, leeching cash out or things like that, that somehow they would end up with a more efficient system. But that's idiocy to my mind. You know, that's the classic I've got a toy model. If I controlled all the variables, it would work perfectly. Well, that's wonderful, guys, but the world isn't a toy. And unfortunately, society doesn't operate like a model. If you don't accept the human element, you are going to screw up time and time again. And guess what? We've refused to accept the human element the last near decade now. And that is exactly why, when you look around in any society right now, it doesn't really matter actually what central banks are doing. People are rewriting the political script already. So, you know, the next government that comes in into a lot of countries in Europe is automatically going to be far more antagonistic to the ECB, no matter what. So unfortunately, you know, that particular chapter, I don't think it's a case of, you know, do things go bad. Things are going bad. Things are going to be turning south. It's just a question of how long it takes to play out.
Does the ECB continue to exist, in your opinion, or does the Eurozone break up?
The Eurozone, I think, will eventually decline. I think, you know, the big flashpoint for them right now is going to be what they do about the Italian banks. I think when you and I spoke a couple of months ago, we talked about Brexit being a much bigger problem for Europe than for Britain. And I think that's very true because, you know, if, say, for example, Renzi's government in Italy collapses over the Italian banking bailout, then the new government in Italy will be the five-star movement. Will be the five-star movement. And, you know, they already are very Eurosceptic. You know, so that's going to be hugely problematic, I think, you know, for the ECB. If you look at many countries around anyway, French, if you look at Germany, where Angela Merkel's party did disastrously in her home state, you know, these are unfortunately they're all going to be growing tension to the ECB. The ECB right now still has a lot of power because politicians are too scared to let go of the monetary lever. It's kind of become their comfort blanket, you know, like Linus and Peanuts, right? It's like, as long as I've got a monetary blanket, I'm okay somehow. So it's having until they let go of it, the ECB isn't in danger. But unfortunately, central banks, to a large extent, one could argue, are becoming victims of their own hyperbole over the last few years.
So, you know, when we look at all the problems, and how come the central banks did not learn from Japan and the mess that they created? I mean, Japan was, I guess, the first, right, at this quantitative easing type of program 30 years ago. And they're still not out of the woods, right? I mean, they're still in the same mess they've always been in. I mean, what is it? Why can't anybody else see that the template doesn't work, what they're doing, and that they need to do something to try something else? I mean, it's a perfect example. You can use Japan. Can you not?
Yeah, I agree. But, I mean, you know, Japan's problem, quite simply put, was one of too much debt, you know, too much bad debt in the system. And, you know, this is why, as I said, I think, you know, the good scenario now for, most central banks is that they can recreate the Japanese experience, that the debt gets very, very slowly eroded by deflation over you know, a very, very long period of time, during which you basically completely screw economic growth. Now, the problem is twofold. One is that, firstly, the Japanese, I will point out, are a very, very docile people. You know, I mean, Japan in many ways took its feudal architecture and just converted that into corporates and everything else. So in Japan, the difference between the individual and society is a very complex one. And so the Japanese have always been in many ways willing to take pain for the sake of, better outcomes. I don't think, unfortunately, most people in the Anglo-Saxon world and the European world are in the same mentality. So that's one issue, and I think that's why we got the changes in political tones there. The second thing is that it's a question of debt. And I think one of the important things to understand here is that most economists, and certainly most policymakers, I don't think fully understand or comprehend debt. To them, debt, equity, capital structures, these are all take the aspects of some corporate balance sheet thing, they make no difference to a macroeconomy, which is actually crap. Because the problem here is that unfortunately too much debt will saturate a system and completely strangle growth. And too much debt, you know, much in the same way, a little bit of debt can accelerate growth, just like a little bit of leverage is great for returns. Too much has the opposite effect. And I think the very fact they still haven't understood that is what terrifies me. They've not written down any debt, they've simply added more on.
So, you bring up all these great points. Now, why can't they understand? I mean, it's not that complicated. Is it that they can't understand or they don't want to understand? What is your opinion?
I think, firstly, there's issues around trying to understand what leverage really means. I think from their perspective, government debt is relatively meaningless because the government, to a large extent, can always restructure its debt ad infinitum. I mean, let's go back to the war loan, which was the World War One that the UK had. You know, they simply restructured into a perpetual loan. So in many ways, what they actually did was write it off, but simply by claiming that this debt somehow exists, people still trade this war loan, right? Because it's a perpetual bond, even though it does not actually exist. There's that belief. And I think there's also the fact that... So the problem with debt is that, much like leverage, as we were discussing, a little bit is great for growth. Too much is bad. And I think policymakers, unfortunately, haven't fully understood that. And, tragically, instead of actually working it out, which is what would have been a sensible thing. In many ways, what should have done is done QE to bail out the banks, perhaps, but use that money not so much to simply throw money at a problem and hope it goes away, but actually to start working out bad assets and bad debts. And leverage, I think, is a concept that sort of eludes many of them. I mean, a simple example, let's take any of the pension plans in the U.S., CalPERS, for example, right? CalPERS owns a lot of assets. Those assets predominantly will be a mix of, equities, debt instruments, private equity, hedge funds, etc. But, what I think people don't fully appreciate is that much in the same way that you got this whole overhang of debt in the world, well, all that overhang of debt is also somebody else's asset. Every corporate bond issued out there, every loan made to some homeowner, every car loan, every, student loan, all of that is an asset sitting on someone's balance sheet and almost certainly sitting on the balance sheet of some large institution somewhere in the world. And then, so these institutions are actually, they may think they've got significant assets, but they actually have significant amounts of leverage. And I think, politicians don't fully understand this, policymakers don't fully understand this. And so this whole notion of debt, savings, etc., it eludes them. It's something that hasn't been core to how they've thought about economic policy for the last, I would say, probably half century. And, now they're struggling to get up to speed on all of this. I mean, there is some work going into it, but there's a steep learning curve that they still have to get through.
My personal opinion is they don't want to learn the learning curve. I think that they... between the politicians and the Federal Reserve, I think they like what they have because they have total control, and all they're doing is devaluing everything and turning the entire system into a socialism system. But this is Dr. Bob Swarup, Camdor Global, the man. He gets it, got it all, author of Money Mania, Panics, Booms, and Busts, bestseller. Make sure you check it out. This is The Bubba Show, Top Bob Horowitz. When you miss an episode, libertytalk.fm gets you the download of not only The Bubba Show, but The Sporting Edge. We'll be back with more from Dr. Bob after the break. The Bubba Show, Top Bob Horowitz. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Bubba Show, Top Bob Horowitz with Dr. Bob Swarup, Camdor Global, as well as the author of the bestseller, Money Mania, Panics, Booms, and Busts. And I know, Dr. Bob, we're going to have another panic and another bust here. Nobody knows when. We can't predict it, but certainly it's stacking up on the cards, is it not?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think, if you think about it, the stat I always remember is that Western Europe, there's been a financial crisis on average once a decade for the last 400 years. So if you take that as a rough line in the sand, we had one in 2007, we're kind of overdue, one pretty soon, say next year. I think, looking at the system right now, we still have a little bit further to run because, they're now throwing more and more money at the problem. I think it's interesting that regulation in many ways, of course, allows them to perpetuate this, because if you look at the way regulation has evolved, one of the reasons why all this crazy debt can get issued and picked up is simply because most investors, both banks and insurance companies, from a regulatory perspective, are very, very much driven to purchase a lot of this stuff in order to make their own business models as efficient as possible, especially in this environment. So I think in many ways the system at the moment is unfortunately, you know, buying its own debt, eating its own debt. The real tragedy, to my mind, is that while they're doing all of this monetary shenanigans at the top level, underneath it, the economic narrative is disintegrating. The social fabric and certainly the buy-in that a society has to have in its government is decaying rapidly. And I don't see anything being done to change that. I see a lot of opinion pieces, by the way, in the New York Times and elsewhere about the tragedy of inequality and rising inequality, all the wonderful things like that. But unfortunately, solutions that most people trot out really come down to some form either of redistribution or, within quotes, strong iron-handed leadership. There is no real attempt to actually, you know, tackle some of the root causes of this, which is, for example, the, you know, corrosive impact of debt on most people's livelihoods now, and also, you know, the fact that actually there has been a complete disconnect between policymakers and the priorities of most people in society.
So, you know, we have obviously the problems, and of course we'll come out of them. I mean, this is not, you know, we can go back to one of the ones I always laugh at is what we call the South Sea Bubble, which, you know, broke Sir Isaac Newton. Of course, that final debt payment was just made, I think, about a year ago from the 1700s. So we know that they love to restructure debt because they can keep it on their balance sheet. But at the end of the day, too much debt is never good, and you can never service it. You cannot continue to rewrite it, which I think is a backwards theory of the way banks think in general. And I think the way that the government looks at money, you cannot continue to refinance. It's like, you know, buying a new car every year on time and just adding back into the depreciation. It doesn't work. You go broke. Am I wrong or right there?
No, I think the debt gradually becomes more and more devalued over time. You know, what you're like now and reliving is the 1920s, where, you know, the debt becomes worth less and less. It becomes more and more insurmountable to pay off. And everyone tries to restructure, but no one really succeeds and no one really agrees. And eventually, you know, countries do it unilaterally, right? I mean, in the Great Depression, you know, what actually happened was most countries just turned around and defaulted on their debt on their own. And I think, you know, we're getting to the point where you will see, you know, if I had to look over, let's say, for the sake of argument, a 20-year horizon, when you can't make predictions in a sense about where stock markets go or bond markets go or where central banks go, I think I'm pretty sure that if I look at that, you've been through a half century where returns to capital have been extremely high compared to returns to labor. In fact, one could argue that there's been this kind of forced impact between, you know, capital and labor, where basically you suppress the wages of whether it was workers in America or workers in China in return for accelerated economic growth. And at least the promise was that, guys, take an effective pay cut now and we'll pay you by giving you this guarantee of a pension tomorrow or a better future tomorrow and things like that. Now, because that promise hasn't been kept in people's minds, people feel worried about their future. What we're starting to see is all the populist narrative that's coming in, whether it's a Trump or a Sanders, whether it's left-wing or right-wing, is one which basically is now fighting in some form for the worker. So I would say over the next 20, 25 years, you will start to see a reversal. You will start to see that returns to labor will rise, and unfortunately, the expense of returns to capital. So, you know, as far as economies are concerned, this obsession they have with economic growth in terms of a growing pie, etc., that will start to decline. It may stagnate, it may go down in real terms, it will decline. And what you'll see instead is a move towards giving ultimately people higher wages, you know, trying to secure benefits, trying to, you know, to do things like that in a way of creating the anger that's building across most society. And don't forget, most people, by the way, may be exposed to financial markets indirectly, but very few people actually directly are involved in this. So it's very easy for that whole area to be put on the bonfire. if society wants.
So, you know, we've got, you've mentioned CalPERS, you mentioned some of the pension funds. Of course, Central States is known. The facts are that they pay out $3.84 for every dollar they take in. So obviously that has to end quickly and eventually. Is there a way to salvage anything here without just basically saying we're not paying and we're done and it's over, goodbye? I mean, is there a way to get out of this mess the way you see it?
Look, I think there's plenty of ways to get out of this mess. I mean, you know, for example, you know, I mean, look, but the example I would simply use is that we know that when somebody goes bankrupt or when a company can no longer, you know, meet all its obligations, there's a pretty well-trodden path to insolvency, right?
Yeah.
Well, we're a long way away from the days when we sent a guy off to debtor's prison or whatever. You restructure, right? You take the assets that you can, you pay out what you can, everyone goes away with some recovery, and you move on. The important thing is that what you accept, and I think what everyone bought into as to why we bothered doing, you know, restructurings for a company and for an individual, is we kind of got to the point where we realized that it was much better to wind things down in an orderly fashion, wipe the slate clean, and let's start all over again, because that's probably the best thing for economic growth in general. And what's interesting is that, unfortunately, there's no way at the moment, or there is no structure in place for a sovereign to declare bankruptcy, or for a society to decide how it wants to restructure its debt burdens. And I think you, unfortunately, will have to think about a bigger program of debt forgiveness, if you want to call it that, or debt restructuring. I mean, they're both the same thing, really. Where you have to look across all the benefits that have been promised, and you have to really look and see which of these are sustainable and which of these are not. And unfortunately, the problem is on the promises that were made were far too grand. I mean, CalPERS is a good example. CalPERS, I would argue, is bankrupt already. I mean, it's been promising to make 8% of its assets for years now, and it's only making about 3% in reality. Now, if you back that into their liabilities and think about what that really means for the deficit, you know, you'd probably find out that CalPERS is, I would say, you know, maybe, I don't know, 40% funded. I mean, CalPERS is a huge hole. You don't come back from that hole easily. The only question is, you know, it's a crisis in slow motion. How long do you keep staving off the inevitable before suddenly it turns around and bites you?
And again, that's I think that is right there, I believe, to be the biggest problem. And I think that's the problem that the Fed created, is you cannot kick the can down the road. You have to at some point say, okay, let's let the chips fall where they may. We know that it can't be good, but once it's all done, we can then restructure and we can go back to being a strong economy after it happens. Would that be correct?
No, you're right. I mean, look, I mean, going back to CalPERS for a second, I mean, the only reason why CalPERS getting crucified is, you know, the fact that the macros and liabilities are basically discounted at the yield curve, you know, plus a spread, whatever it might be. But in general, that's very discount the liabilities. Now, the problem is, if you keep pushing the yield curve down, you might keep a whole bunch of zombie, you know, debt holders and companies alive, but you also crucify the people who actually, unfortunately, on the other side, have to, you know, pay out liabilities. You know, their liabilities just keep growing and growing. So, you know, just a simple example, if you were to raise the yield curve by, say, about 1% across the board, you would probably reduce CalPERS liabilities by somewhere in the region of 20%. You know?
I mean, there you go. There's our solution for today.
What a powerful impact.
That's our solution for today. We'll get Dr. Bob back to finish. I know we got to cut it. This is Dr. Bob Swarup, Camdor Global. I'll get you back on again because I know you got the great stuff. Bob, thanks so much for coming on. I always appreciate having you on.
Always a pleasure, Bob. Always a pleasure.
This is the Bubba Show, Todd Bob Horst. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Same time, same station. Dr. Bob Swarup, we appreciate his time. He's always on top of it. LibertyTalk.fm, we'll get you the podcast. Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow. Thank you so much for the Bubba Show. We'll see you tomorrow.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.